to us.
Father, how you have looked at us individually, one by one, giving us what we need from you. Lord, we're asking you this morning to open our minds so that we might understand what we will be given this morning from you. Lord, give us a receptive heart to receive and fold it into our lives. Lord, give us a will to do that you would have us to do. Father, bless our teacher this morning. Word his mouth, Lord. Speak to us through him. In the name of Jesus.
Thanks, Bob. Just a few announcements before we get started. Let's see. We'll do Preston in a minute. There is quite a need during Sunday morning and on Wednesday evening for teachers for our kids. So if you'd like to be involved in that, there's several openings. You can find out about them down on the patio. But there's several classes that are closed at the moment. And if you'd like to be a part of that, if God calls you to do that, that's a great ministry, a wonderful joy, and a bit of a challenge at times. But that's really a great opportunity. Also, specifically, I know about an opening on Wednesday evening for what they call the Scooter Boys in Pioneer Club. And those are the youngest kids, 4 and 5 years old. And they have tons of energy. They tend to bounce off the wall for most of the hour. And they combine them with the girls for now. And I think if we could get a couple men, maybe out of this class, maybe not, but that would probably be a better setup for all involved. Because if you've ever walked by those classes, the girls are sitting nice in a circle with their hands folded, listening with just undivided attention to their leaders, who look like pros, and then if you've ever walked by the boys, the leaders look like complete incompetents, and the boys are wrestling with each other in the corner. So, having done that for a year myself, I can speak from firsthand experience. But it's a great ministry, whether you do it Sunday morning or Wednesday evening. So, pray about that, or if you know somebody that you think is gifted in that way, encourage them to be a part of that as well. So, that's one announcement I want to make. And Preston wants to talk about Straight Talk, so I'll let him mention that.
Thanks.
Yeah, this year's lineup is really interesting. Perhaps the best part of the deal, though, is that it's only $5, because they've changed the location from Ricky's, which you can see has been torn down, to right behind Ace Hardware in Menlo Park on Santa Cruz Avenue. So it's in that little alley behind. They call 700B. anyways, the lineup this year starts off with Guy Kawasaki. Next one is Rich Carlsbad. He's my favorite because I had a chance to hang out with him for a day. He's the editor of Forbes magazine. Now, these are dependably Christian people in a non-threatening atmosphere. Just perfect for inviting some colleague of yours to come and hear how balance and integrity and all those buzzwords actually happen with Christians in the workplace. So the rest of them include Tony Perkins, used to be the Red Herring magazine founder, now is with Always On. He's a new one for me. Somebody recruited him, said he's just new this way. You can check him out on the website, Always On is the website. We've got Ken Starr, we have Chuck Colson, he's coming with his right-hand man, Warren. Chuck Colson, we've never been able to get him before. And he's coming at a small venue. I mean, it's only going to pack in maybe about 300 people at the most. And if we have too many people, we're hot-wired to place that they meet at Menlo for discussions and stuff. The rest of the people, it seems like we're finishing up with Brent Jones for the 49ers. We have a high-tech panel before that. And let's skip anybody. Tony Campolo is coming back. Coming back December 9th. Maybe we'll finally hear what he really did with our former president. He was apparently the spiritual advisor to Bill Clinton. Somebody better try to nail him down, I'm sure, in private or in public. Anyways, I'm also, even though this starts October 14th, I'm also trying to recruit a few table discussion leaders this coming Friday from 7:30 to 8:30 in that location. We're going to have kind of a dry run with all the table discussion leaders, and they're going to feed us some bagels, I guess. I guess that's all you get for $5.
Straight Talk is a breakfast ministry. Is it once a month, Fred?
Yes. It's usually either the first or second Friday. At 7, the actual meeting start at 7 and finish promptly at 8:30.
Okay, so it's a breakfast, either first or second Friday of each month, and it's a ministry of mental presence. Neat that Preston and others from this body have been involved for many years, because that's churches working together across the boundaries of the building with a name on the front, and so that they get some amazing folks to come to that. And that's a great place to take, as Preston mentioned, your colleagues and friends to a non-threatening setting where they might find out more about the Lord. Sally's back with the brief mention on the prayer books, right?
Right.
Got those? Go ahead.
Sure. 30 Days of Prayer. If you're interested in learning about the Muslim world, it gives you very positive ideas about what God's doing all over the world rather than the kind of bad news we get a lot of. Praying during Ramadan. There's a selection for each of the 30 days. If you'd like one, come see me. $3, please.
Great. Tonight, 5 o'clock, there's a hymn sing till 6:15, then a potluck, and then followed with some more singing afterwards. So Larry's been involved in that. Thanks, Larry. Good work. They're going to take an offering, I think, at both hours for the hurricane victims down in the southeast. So that's a great chance to be a part of singing your favorite hymns or your favorite contemporary songs. So we hope to see you there. I think there's a whole slew of folks in here for the first time, but I'm just going on what I see. Anybody want to admit that they're here for the first time? You just say your name. No, right here. It's you both.
Joyce.
Joyce, welcome. Where are you from?
Palo Alto.
Palo Alto. Great. What took you so long? No, sorry. Thanks. We're glad you're here. Seriously. No problem. Seriously, we're glad you're here. Anybody else? Yeah, somebody wants to introduce me.
This is my friend Tamari, and this is the first time here.
Tamari.
Yes.
Yay, welcome.
And her sister, Parish Cemetery.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Where do you live at?
In Cemetery.
Yes. Welcome. Thanks for joining us. Anybody else? Yeah, way in the back, Marilyn.
Kurt Washington is a family friend from the
town. Kurt, welcome. Thanks for joining us this morning. You can all applaud. That's okay. Okay. If a John wants to say something, John.
Just soliciting recommendations. We don't usually take this approach to it, but we do have a need for a greeter or two at the first service on the first Sunday of the month. So if that's an area of ministry that you or someone that you know you think might be interested in, let me know, and I'll let you know what it's all about. Connect you with a veteran so that you actually know the truth.
Okay, thanks. If a basket goes by you, that just covers our expenses for the class. Please don't feel any obligation to give. Just give as the Lord leads you in that regard. And with that, Lambert, thanks for leading us in our study of Leviticus.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Big crowd here. You are well into Leviticus. If you're new, you'll want to get to do the makeup exams. And the best commentary I know of on Leviticus is a new one by Ray Sedman, which is in the bookstore, just published this year, and for me has unlocked this mysterious book of Leviticus in the Old Testament, where most people bog down and close their Bibles when they intended to read all the way through. key verse in Leviticus, you'll remember, is the verse where God says, you must be holy because I am holy. It's about holiness. And as Ray points out, holiness has to do with wholeness, with well-roundedness, with fulfillment, with attaining the designer's purpose for your life when he built you, when God built you to be the person that he wanted you to be. The wholeness is the realization of that. The whole subject of holiness is complicated. Holiness is the highest of God's attributes. Remember that Isaiah had the vision of God in which he saw the Lord in the temple, high and exalted, and angels calling out, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God of hosts. The whole earth is filled with his glory." And that threefold repetition of the word holy is the Hebrew way of putting the strongest emphasis on holiness as an attribute of God. Long years ago, R.C. Sproul did a series of six sermons on the holiness of God, which I consider great classics. I have them on my website at MP3 if you want to listen to them for free. And the book, The Holiness of God, would be a really all-time great book to help you perceive something about the awesomeness of God, something about the otherness of God, which we need, something to transcend it, the mystery of God's being that's both frightening and inspiring. That's an aspect of holiness that we haven't touched upon exactly in our studies in Leviticus, but it would be something very important, obviously, to be aware of. Professor John Aniker called me this week to remind me that long years ago, 40 years ago, a doctor by the name of S.I. McMillan wrote a little book, None of These Diseases. And I looked on the internet, on Amazon, and here's a 75-cent copy. That's the price in 1970. And I noticed that it's still in print, actually, having sold millions of copies, and it's very, very good reading. It's just kind of all sorts of practical information on health and sanitation and wholesome living coming derived from the Book of Leviticus. And it's just really excellent. It also goes into the history of how the Book of Leviticus has influenced civilization as far as medical care and sanitary procedures and how to handle diseases and a number of practical guides to the whole theme that living in a close harmony with God is connected with good physical health and long life and happiness, all corollaries to the Book of Leviticus. So this book, it costs a couple of bucks if you order one of the used copies from Amazon, and it's excellent reading. So I'd recommend that. Last time, we talked about the Jewish New Year, which is coming up in early October in the month of Tishri. On the first day of Tishri is the Jewish holiday observed to this day of Rosh Hashanah, which means head of the year. It means the Jewish New Year. Since Leviticus, quite a bit has changed in this tradition for the Jews. For example, the Jews no longer have today animal sacrifices, so some parts of this ceremony, which goes on from Rosh Hashanah for 10 days up till Yom Kippur, some of the things are different now. But the whole idea, which we did in Leviticus, we had last week in Leviticus 16, is that once a year the Jewish people could gather together for a time of solemn reflection and heart-to-heart repentance and self-examination. In modern Jewish tradition, this is still observed, a time of 10 days of self-examination, a time particularly of clearing up any issues that you might have with a brother or a sister, any unfinished business, any bitterness, any unpaid debts, any unfulfilled obligations, any temper tantrums that you had that you didn't go get fixed, or any vows that you didn't keep. And it becomes for the Jews a 10-day period, which is vitally important to worry about your relationship with your fellow human beings and to examine your own conscience. Because on the Day of Atonement would be a day in which the great high priest goes into the presence of God to deal with the sins of the nation, the catch-all, not the trespass sins, you've already dealt with all those, but the overall sins that we might have overlooked or we might have missed or maybe great sins, just to make sure that the whole nation was in right standing with God. And we looked last week at the very elaborate ritual which God gave to Aaron, the brother of Moses, the great high priest of Israel, all of the detailed protocol, which pictures for us the great work of Jesus Christ himself, whose blood was a once and for all sacrifice for sins, whose blood cleansed the holy place in heaven, not just the tabernacle or the temple. But in the shadows in Leviticus, we get a lot of interesting information. First of all, we find that Moses, that Aaron, had to do all of this work on the Day of Atonement all by himself, the nation standing by, carefully watching, and Moses and Aaron taking great care to make sure that everything was done correctly. The great high priest had to do the work all by himself. He had to make a number of trips into the Holy of Holies. It was forbidden to go into the Holy of Holies except once a year, and the first thing that the great high priest had to do in going into the Holy of Holies was to fill the Holy of Holies with a great cloud of incense so that he should not look upon the face of God. And then he proceeded to offer blood sacrifices for his own sins, because he, Aaron, was a sinful man like everybody. And he had to also include any sins, atone for any sins that his family might have committed. Having done that, he was now then in a position of making atonement for the sins of the whole nation with sacrifices. There were washings and cleansings involved. It was important that the holy place be cleansed by blood. It was important that the altar be cleansed by blood, that the tabernacle be cleansed by blood, that everything be done by the book. And you can imagine that he didn't have with him an assistant to remind him of the next step, and he took care to follow the exact details. We talked also last time about the part of the atonement for the people, which involved two goats. One goat was sacrificed and offered as an atonement, and the second goat became the scapegoat or the escape goat. Then the sins of the people were symbolically laid upon that goat, and the goat was sent out into the wilderness. All of these are pictures and shadows to show us how complete is the sacrifice of Jesus for us. In his death on the cross, Jesus fulfilled all of the demands of the law, and he provided for every possible area of our lives that we could be holy, that we could go now, all of us, into the Holy of Holies ourselves. We now have full access. And these sacrifices would never need to be repeated again. They're once for all, and they're very thorough. And in Leviticus, we see that how thorough the work of Christ was on the cross. Well, that was chapter 16. Let's look today at chapters 17 and 18. These are kind of strange and a little foreign to us, that chapter 17 is all about blood. The Lord said to Moses, saying, "Speak to Aaron, to his sons, and to all of his children under Israel, and say to them, this is the thing which the Lord has commanded, saying, whatever man of the house of Israel kills an ox or a lamb or a goat in the camp, or who kills it outside the camp, and does not bring it into the door of the tabernacle of the meeting, to offer an offering to the Lord before the tabernacle of the Lord, blood guilt shall be imputed to that man. He has shed blood, and that man will be cut off from among his people." Now, meat wasn't a regular part of the diet of most of the Jewish people. They couldn't afford to sacrifice their lambs and their goats and their cows as freely as we do in our culture today, so that you could have meat with every meal. It would be not an ordinary occasion. The ordinary diet would be fruit and cereals and vegetables and fish. But if you chose to offer a lamb, to kill a lamb, or say, for example, for a family gathering or a family meal, something's very, very important about how you do that. It's not forbidden to kill one of your animals. But there's something here that is forbidden, and it's forbidden with a very severe penalty attached to it. the person who kills this animal and does not get involved with the tabernacle is being considered cut off from his people. That's about banished, in other words, excommunicated. That's about the most severe sentence. We have some penalties here in Leviticus. The lightest penalty would be to be ceremonially unclean. That would be equivalent to us doing something in the flesh, speaking in the flesh, acting in the flesh, which would be a short-term defilement that would pass. But this is a pretty severe defilement, and it sounds to us rather strange. Verse 5. To the end that the children of Israel may bring their sacrifices, which they offer in the open field, that they may bring them to the Lord at the door of the tabernacle of meeting, to the priest, and offer them as peace offerings to the Lord. The priest shall sprinkle the blood on the altar of the Lord at the door of the tabernacle of meeting, and burn the fat for a sweet aroma to the Lord. So you want to have roast-legged lamb next week. You bring the lamb to the tabernacle and have it killed and its blood poured out at the tabernacle and have it offered to the Lord as a peace offering. Now, the peace offering has a particular purpose, and the peace offering is an offering that you can eat. What's the peace offering about? It's some aspect of Jesus is symbolized in the peace offering. This is number 3 of the 5 offerings. Well, it's peace with God, obviously. What this is about, maintaining peace with God. So it's okay to kill one of your farm animals. It's okay to put together a meal, but it's terribly important that you do this in conjunction with the ceremonies of the tabernacle. And why is that? Well, we read on a little bit. It says, they shall no more offer their sacrifices to demons, after whom they have played the harlot. There shall be a statue forever for them through their generations. You shall say to them, whatever man of the house of Israel or of the strangers who sojourns among you who offers a burnt offering or sacrifice and does not bring it to the door of the tabernacle of meeting to offer it to the Lord, this man shall be cut off from his people. Whatever man of the house of Israel or the strangers, visitors who sojourn among you, who eats any blood, I will set my face against that person who eats blood, and I will cut him off from among his people. For the life of the flesh is in the blood, and I have given it to you upon the altar to make atonement for your souls. It is the blood that makes atonement for the soul. Therefore I said to the children of Israel, no one among you shall eat blood, nor shall any stranger who hunts among you eat blood. Now, there's a provision here. If you're hunting, Israel was forested and had a lot of wild animals, deer, and all kinds of wild animals, and you can hunt if you want. Whatever man of the children of Israel or of the strangers who sojourn among you who hunts and catches any animal or bird that may be eaten, that is in the approved dietary list, he shall pour out its blood and cover it with dust. For it is the life of it all flesh. Its blood sustains its life. Therefore I said to the children of Israel, you shall not eat the blood of any flesh, for the life of all flesh is its blood. Whoever eats it shall be cut off. And every person who eats what died naturally, or what was torn by beasts, whether he is a native of his own country or a stranger, he shall both wash his clothes and bathe in water and shall be unclean until evening. Then he shall be clean, and if he does not wash or bathe his body, then he shall bear his guilt. There are probably 3 important points in here. 3 points. Why is it terribly important that you, when an animal is killed, that it be brought to the tabernacle and made part of the peace offering? What's the primary reason for that? In that culture.
Is it to keep you from offering it to a false god?
Yes, exactly. Life belongs to God. All life belongs to God. And life is symbolized by the blood, and it's very, very common in the pagan world to offer blood sacrifices to demons. Ray mentions being in the Philippines once and going up into northern Luzon and witnessing the sacrificing of a chicken with mutterings and the demons and spirits. And I had the same experience in the Philippines that visiting a village some years ago and witnessing the sacrifice of a chicken with the very same thing, very weird and very strange. So to this day, in foreign lands, you go to a Mecca during the Ramadan, and lambs are sacrificed to Allah by the millions, and blood sacrifices to the wrong god. And so in the ancient world, the offering and the shedding of blood to demons was a way of placating the demons, a way of buying the demons good favor. Look at the Aztecs and the Mayans and the Indians of Central America who killed their enemies by the thousands and thousands to get the sun god to be favorable to them. So then in this symbolism of shedding blood, God says, all life belongs to me, and I want you to treat all of life with reverence. And if you'll remember the purpose of the peace offering and the teachings that go with the peace offering, then you can be thankful for God's provision of life and his provision of food. Today we take it for granted. You go to the supermarket and here's all the beef and the lamb and the chicken and the fish all laid out, and we have no idea of how these animals have been raised and how they've been slaughtered. We know that they're inspected and clean, but we take it for granted that meat comes from Safeways or Albertsons, when in fact the back of that long chain, it comes from God.
Is the Hebrew word used here when it says to sacrifice the animal, it's not like slaughter? Is it like sacrifice implying religious connotations as opposed to slaughter, which you would just kill for?
This is just the idea of if you kill an animal. Now, it's okay to kill a wild animal if you're a long ways out of town and you find a deer and there are plenty of deer around, you kill the deer and take it home, that's all right. Not just for sport, obviously. What would be wrong with picking up a dead animal that you saw in the forest that had just died?
It might have disease. It might be disease.
It's very likely started to decay, and so this would be a simple sanitary precaution. You wouldn't want to touch the dead animal. You don't know why it died. Maybe it died of a disease or it started to decay. If you did accidentally touch it, you'd wash it and not bring any contagion into the back in the camp. So that's just another one of these very logical sanitary principles. Anything else in here?
Well, I was just going to say, is maybe for the modern day, is this idea of bringing the sacrifice to the tent of meeting an admonition to us not to roll our own religion, not to make it up as we go? I mean, we don't sacrifice to demons typically, but we frequently create the god we want instead of the
and
god
worship him the way we want to. I think it really is, it's sobering if you stop to realize that animals, beautiful animals, give their lives for us to have food and sustenance. And the love of God is in that giving of animals to us as part of our food supply. And there ought to be a thankfulness and a reverence to God who is the creator. The thought of killing a lamb or killing a cow or a sheep or a goat is not exactly pleasant to me to think about it. And it goes on. And I'm very concerned when I see the way that animals are raised today in pens and stalls and cooped up without any freedom to travel around on the range. Now, is it okay today to eat blood products? Is it okay to do blood transfusions? The Jehovah's Witnesses say you can't have blood transfusions. Well, there's nothing in here about blood transfusions, and they were certainly unknown in Leviticus, and it's quite another matter, so it's really not mentioned here. But is it all right to have blood pudding, or what is the sausage that's... Is that all right? Is that clean? Is that okay? Yeah, it is. We have no dietary prohibitions on us under the New Covenant. These, apart from the sanitary logic in cleanliness and healthiness, all these dietary laws are teaching symbols.
What about some countries like cook the chicken and then
it would not be okay under the Levitical law, but it's okay for us because all foods are clean. I mentioned that Ray Sedman was in the Singapore someplace and was offered chocolate-covered grasshoppers, and he declined on the ground that he didn't like chocolate. But if you go, it's not unusual in the Orient to find all manner of exotic insects and creatures for dinner, and if you like them, fine. There's no panic, no problem. Yeah.
Why would they supposed to eat the fat?
Why not? That's good, but how come the fat goes on the altar and gets burned up? That's symbolic. It's okay to eat fat if you want to ruin your cholesterol. But why in the Old Testament would the fat always be burned on the altar? Symbol of something.
The best part.
Yeah. The best
riches
part.
Fat symbolizes richness. Richness of life. And richness of life belongs to the Lord. Richness, if you're blessed and beyond your own normal weight range, or if you're really blessed in life, you should recognize that the source of that blessing comes from God and it's not from your own efforts. I think that's the idea between some of this symbolism is a little strange to us. We don't live in this kind of rural society in close harmony with the land, with our own animals and our own crops. But we are dealing with the same God. So now we want to move to chapter 18, which is about SEX. And there's a little bit more about sexuality and the Levitical principles in that makes Leviticus in the sense of kind of a scary book. Last week I gave you a sermon by a gentleman from Richardson, Texas, a pastor, Dallas graduate group, on the fundamental, it's kind of fundamental outline of this particular chapter. There are probably extra copies if you weren't here and you can pick one up. But I found that particular sermon really was just right on target. In the opening verses of this, the first few verses of chapter 18, let's look at that and see what this is about. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel, and say to them, I am the Lord your God." Now that phrase, "I am the Lord your God," or "I am Yahweh your God," is repeated 5 times in this chapter, and that's always a covenant term. That's a covenant term. You and I have a personal relationship, remember. You and I have a one-on-one personal relationship. I'm the God of personal relationships. I'm the God of holiness. We entered into a covenant agreement together. I'm reminding you of that covenant. So this covenant language. "Speak to the children of Israel and say, I am the Lord your God. According to the doings of the land of Egypt where you dwelt, you shall not do. And according to the doings of the land of Canaan where I'm bringing you, you shall not do. Nor shall you walk in their ordinances. You shall observe my judgments and keep my ordinances to walk in them. I am the Lord your God." Now, right offhand, that sounds like rules and regulations. And let's see if we can make this real in a contemporary way. What is God saying to Israel after he's taken them out of Egypt? And he's given them a whole bunch of principles for living. And he's also going to put them in the land occupied by Canaanites, who were very pagan, like most Californians are. And God said something here. What did he say, really? You must not, as the Egyptians do, you must not live the same kind of lifestyles the Egyptians do. Does that make it better than you're not going to go by the laws of Egypt or the statutes and ordinances of Egypt? Really not about that. It's really about lifestyles, isn't it?
Say, what is, it reminds me of like God is now, I really want you to listen. I guess what I'm about to tell you is very, very important to you. Just like Jesus, when he wants to emphasize, he says, truly, truly, when he says, truly, truly, this is really important.
That's right. That's exactly right. This is one of those barely, barely, truly, truly, amen, amen. Pay attention, folks. You must not live the way the Egyptians live. You must not live the way the Canaanites live. And where are the Egyptians and the Canaanites today? Well, they are right here in Silicon Valley on all sides. And very, very clearly, God says, you guys have got to live a radically different kind of life. In everything that you do and everything that you believe and in all of your situations, you must be a holy, separated, different people. That's the whole purpose about God redeeming us. He bought us out of Egypt. He redeemed us. He paid a huge price to set us free from sin. We were slaves of sin. We were slaves to Pharaoh, the god of this world. We're in a culture that's just about as Canaanite as it possibly could be, with all the rampant immorality on all sides. And God says, if you live like the Egyptians or like the Canaanites, you will short-circuit my plan for your holiness. You will make it impossible for me to make you into the whole man or woman that I want to make you into. You'll frustrate my plan. That sort of makes sense? That doesn't sound like much legalism at all if you put that in those terms. So you want to realize, once again, we come around to the idea of a separated people. Not just separated individuals, but a separated community, living a distinctively different lifestyle with distinctively different goals, directions.
It reminds me of the sermon this morning from Amos, telling us to be a light in the world. You have to live a certain way.
As Christians, God would like us to be a light to the Gentiles. He would like us to show the world around us what the whole of humanity is all about, and He would like us to be salt. He'd like us to have a preserving action, effect on the culture to arrest the moral decay. And many, many times Ray has called attention to the fact that the church is the secret government of the world. That as the church goes, so goes the world. Something's wrong in the society, and you put the finger on the church, fix what's wrong in the church, and the culture will respond. That's the leverage we have as Christians. Small number of Christians in a world that seems to be overwhelmingly evil, and yet it's our behavior with the Lord that is the behind-the-scenes catalyst to change and affecting the whole culture. That doesn't mean that we're going to get godly moral behavior out of all the ungodly people, but it means big change. Now, let's go look a little bit. There's three levels here in the idea of sexuality, which starts in verse 6. None of you shall approach anyone who is next of kin to him to uncover his nakedness. I am the Lord. Now, uncover his nakedness is a euphemism. Obviously, it's a nice, polite Hebrew way of saying have sex with or have sexual relationships with. And there's a long list that starts at verse 6 and runs on down to verse 18 of the prohibition here of sexual relationships with any family members. I get about 300 or 400 spams every day, and I have to throw them out. And a lot of those spams are solicitations for internet porn, which are, I've noticed in the last 5 years, they get worse and worse and worse. And now I'm finding all kinds of solicitations to come to this website or that website and get involved in some kind of incestuous relationship with a family member. Absolutely terrible. Well, that's Canaanite living in America today. And these verses here from verses 6 to 18 are strong prohibitions against any sexual relationships with immediate family members. That's very strongly prohibited in the law of Moses. There are two reasons for that. There are two good, sound reasons for it. And you can probably guess what they are. We might also, the other thing that I was really startled by as I read that particular sermon I mentioned was that to the Jews, sexual intercourse equals marriage. That little formula, sexual intercourse equals marriage, is absolutely at the heart of Jewish family values. That means premarital sex was virtually unknown among the people of Israel. It didn't come up. It wasn't this topic that was unthinkably uncommon. That's a pretty far cry from the world today. It's one thing, of course, if the pagans are engaging themselves in all kinds of forbidden sexual practices, but it's quite another thing when these same things are almost as common in the church, in the separated people. All right, why are these prohibitions against incest at the first level of seriousness in God's eyes? Two reasons. One of them is biological. Genetic, close intermarriage in a family weakens, means that the probability of genetic flaws in the husband will coincide with the same genetic flaw in the wife, and the child will be born mentally or physically defective. And this has happened in the bloodlines of what the De Medicis and some of the kings of Spain and pharaohs of Egypt down through history, and you get genetic deformity in a couple of generations. So part of it's biological. You marry somebody that's not in your family, you've got genetic damage, she's got genetic damage, it's unlikely that your children will have that damaged genes will line up. Okay, that's one reason. Now there's an even more important reason here for this strong prohibition against any kind of sexual activity within family units, within the family. Probably intuitively kind of obvious. We're kind of disgusting and abhorrent and unthinkable. And what does this do if it's never happened in a family or somebody you know of? What's the effect on a family if one of the family members has gotten himself or herself involved in some kind of sexual misbehavior with another family member? What's that do to the dynamics of family life? It absolutely ruins the dynamics of warmth and love and communication and natural affection. And the damage goes on for generations in many cases. And you still have to take these, kind of include that person who's misbehaved as a family member, but they're always in the sort of outcast or suspected or distrusted.
Why was it allowed at the beginning of the biblical time?
Now, this is interesting. Back in the Genesis, who did Cain marry? Well, Cain married a sister or a cousin, and that wasn't prohibited. So, in fact, all of us are, in fact, brothers and sisters. We're all descendants of Adam and Eve, so it doesn't matter who you marry. You are marrying a brother and sister in that sense. Well, back in the garden, the genetic damage in the race was very small. The family dynamics in the Garden of Eden and thereabouts were terribly different. So this prohibition comes in around the time of the Law of Moses. But obviously, it works very well for us today. Right? This is the inner core that preserves the integrity of the family. And in Leviticus and in the Bible, the family unit is the building block of society. And if you have healthy families, you have a healthy society. If you have dysfunctional families, you have a dysfunctional society. And over again, the whole emphasis in Leviticus and the rest of the Old Testament is family, 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 family. And sexual relationships only in marriage, period. No hanky-panky. Now, there's a little interesting verse back in Leviticus that's repeated a little bit later on. I don't think I probably need that. Exodus 22 says this. If a man entices a virgin who is not betrothed and lies with her, that is, has sex with her, he shall surely pay the bride price for her to be his wife. If her father utterly refuses to give her to him, he shall pay money according to the bride price of virgins. Ordinarily, these transgressions of the law of Moses carry the death penalty, as we'll see a little later on in Leviticus. But let's just suppose that a young man and a young woman get careless and have sexual relationships together on some occasion. There's an option. They don't have to be put to death. They can get married. Because they are already one flesh. It's that biblical idea. They've already started to become one flesh. There's an out. Well, this kind of means that, you know, there's nothing in the Old Testament about dating and about courtship and about finding the right mate. None of that's in there. If you get married to somebody, you're married for life, and you're going to be one flesh together, and God will make it possible for you to live together and enjoy one another, and you're married for life. One flesh, just the whole principle. Now that is very, very foreign to how we do things today. All the kids go out to Christian schools, and then the senior year is the year that you frantically look around for somebody to get married to, and got to get married. And all of the fuss about the person that you're going to marry, and is this the right choice, and is this God's will, and shouldn't we sleep together a while first, and shouldn't we try this out to see if we're compatible, all of that is foreign to biblical way of thinking. It really is foreign. It just doesn't even come up. Now, there's guess I didn't read all these verses from 6 down through 18, but they're all about incestuous relationships in the family. Now we get to verse 19. You shall not approach a woman to uncover her nakedness as long as she is in her customary impurity. That would be just a simple little statement. No sexual intercourse during a woman's menstrual period. That's just part of the law of Moses. But the next one is really heavy duty. This moves to the middle circle of relationships. Moreover, you shall not lie carnally with your neighbor's wife to defile yourself with her. That's adultery. You notice that right away it says that adultery defiles you, and of course it defiles the woman, and it ruins the relationship with your wife, and it ruins the relationship with this other woman's wife, and it's a big, great no-no. Very common for the pagans to do this. Very, very common in the culture around here. No big deal. Turn on all the soap operas. What's going on the soap operas on TV? And all those programs where everybody has sex with everybody and there's no guilt and no consequences and everybody lives happily ever after and this is just the way it is. Well, that's just completely foreign to a biblical worldview. So here right away, just in this one verse, adultery is a very, very serious matter. And correlated with that would be divorce is a very, very, very serious matter. And every possible effort should be made to prevent divorce. I think most pastors here at PBC will tell you horror stories of abusive husbands or difficult marriages or marriages that aren't working as well as they might. And I remember when I was a kid and growing up in Idaho, you never did get a divorce because the neighbors would think ill of you. And a divorced man was likely to be turned down for a promotion at work just because he was a divorced man and therefore tainted. And a divorced woman was untouchable. You know, she was just unclean forever. And even if you had an unhappy marriage, you had to stay together for the sake of the kids and, you know, everybody be miserable. You know, those were the kind of rules. And along with those is you didn't talk about these things. So you can imagine that that's a bit worse than being in jail someplace or other, to not be able to talk about and work through and pray through all of the hard work of being a parent and being a husband or a wife. And marriage is hard work. We don't take covenants seriously, and God does, and marriage is way high up on the list of important covenants. Marriage is not valued highly in our culture today. It is, young people growing up don't have a clue about what marriage is. I talk to kids all the time who are growing up with single parents and a working single parent, and they're going to get married, and how are they going to know what a family is like if they've never had a role model at home? Human children need about 20 years of nurturing. You know, your cat or your dog has kittens and pups, and they start running loose right away, and you turn them loose, and no harm comes out of it. But with kids, the nurturing of a child requires 10, 15 years of a loving, caring family unit. Now, a lot of people, of course, have, for circumstances that are out of their control, are divorced and are single parents, and the single parents deserve as much help as we can give them in the church, support, nurturing. Kids that are growing up with single parents need all of the love and support that we can give them as brothers and sisters, and there's great healing in all that. There's great healing in the community. And divorce does sometimes happen, and divorce is forgivable, but the whole idea is that in getting married, marriage needs to be taken as very seriously. And here, once again, is the implication that adultery affects the whole community, not just the two parties involved. It impacts two families. It impacts the whole community. So once again, it's a matter of concern to the whole community. Verse 21, you shall not let any of your descendants pass through the fire to Molech, nor shall you profane the name of the Lord, of the name of your God, I am the Lord. Molech, the pagan god of the Ammonites, and that this was child sacrifice, essentially. And children were in the pagan world, unwanted children were regularly left to die or sacrificed to a pagan god. And so under no circumstances can you dispose of unwanted children. Modern equivalent? Abortion. About 48 million aborted babies in America, I think last count, who now, many of whom would now be grown up contributing citizens if they hadn't been murdered and deprived of life. And along with abortion, you have to ask, why was that unwanted child conceived in the first place? Where were the mother and father when that child was conceived? Were they unwilling to be responsible for their sexual liaison together? Well, in most cases, these aborted babies are from unmarried girls. And the girls get them in big trouble, and usually the guy isn't caught. And I think guys who get their girlfriends pregnant ought to be hauled in front of court or something or other, and there ought to be some consequences in the pagan society. But the idea here once again comes back to that life is sacred and children are given to us by God, and your child might have birth defects or Down syndrome or something like that, but still loved by God, and you'll be greatly blessed if you'll nurture and love and care for that child and consider the child a gift from God. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was going to add a point.
Please.
I think Ray makes the point that, which we don't often think about, that sexual immorality can lead to sort of this demonic influence of the... think it has no real, you know, supernatural influence, but it can.
Yes, and we get that again. Let's do that at the end of the chapter here a little bit. I remember going to South India with Ted Wise Long in the 70s and staying with some dear Christians down in South India. And our host was a very godly man with a big child, a big bunch of children. And the family would get up at 5 in the morning and gather around the kitchen floor and sing and pray and wake us all up. And it was really neat. And this godly man, they had arranged marriages out there. And so we fed my retreats that these arranged marriages work well. Well, yes, they do. Because the parents from childhood start praying for the right partner for their children and work through the whole life to put the right boy and the right girl together. And then my friend said to me just casually one day, he says, I wouldn't think of having sexual relationships with my wife unless we pray first. But that was kind of a jolt. I've never heard of such a thing. Of course, I'm not married, so I know. Now, there's another third layer of sexual misbehavior, and it's the outer layer, and it is in verses 22 and 23. You shall not lie with a male as with a woman, it is an abomination. That's a prohibition against any kind of homosexual activity of any kind. I've had a long set of emails all week from some guy in Germany who wants to talk to me, convince me that same-sex love is perfectly legitimate. People bring up David and Jonathan as if they were same-sex lovers when in fact they weren't. There was absolutely no sexual conduct between them. Jonathan was 20 years older than David and a good mentor for David and so on. But I'm getting nowhere with this guy. He knows the Bible well, and he's simply redefining the word love to mean something that the Bible doesn't allow for. You shall not lie with a male as with a woman. It is an abomination. So that's any kind of sexual activity between two men. You could infer prohibitions against lesbianism, but evidently lesbianism in the pagan world was less common. The temple cult practices of the Canaanites. When the Canaanites had temples in ancient Israel, they had male and female temple prostitutes. They were in fact called holy ones. And if you wanted some kind of sexual leisure activity, instead of going to a singles bar, you could go to a Canaanite temple and have some kind of holy sex with a temple prostitute, male or female of your choice, and that was perfectly acceptable among the Canaanites. To God, that's absolutely loathsome, repugnant. That word is disgusting, morally abhorrent, the idea. Nor shall you mate with any beast to defile yourself with it. nor shall any woman stand before a beast to mate with it is perversion. That's bestiality, that's sexual activity with an animal, which probably is very abhorrent to most all of us. And is it, does it happen? Yes, it does. Did it happen in the ancient world? Yes. Well, now these last two relationships are violations of creation, violations of the way we were created. Man was made for woman, sex was made for marriage. These, the prohibitions against homosexuality and bestiality are sexual activities that run totally contrary to the way God created the universe. That comes up again in Romans 1. Contrary to nature means contrary to the way God created things to operate. So that's the whole idea. Now you see the circle and the sphere of what God's saying about sexuality. He's putting marriage right at the center of it. Sexuality belongs in marriage, and God does not approve of any kind of sexual expression anyplace else, period. That wonderful little verse in Hebrews I keep quoting when people email me on this. Let the marriage bed be held in honor by all, knowing this, that God will judge the immoral and the ungodly. And the word immoral is the word porneia, which covers all forms of immorality. So there's, in Hebrews, remember Hebrews fulfills Leviticus here. Let marriage be held in high honor by everybody. And let the marriage bed be undefiled, because God will judge the immoral and the ungodly. He will. I've got a great book at home by a Berkeley psychologist, not a Christian, who studied divorce in this country over the last half century. And the whole sexual revolution, divorce rates going from very, very low values up to 50-60% now. And all because of the feminist liberation movement, and all by the introduction of lies into the culture, to the effect that your personal happiness is more important than your marriage. That if you're not in a happy marriage, you owe it to yourself to get a divorce and start a new life. And oh, by the way, the kids won't be affected. Two great big monstrous lies. And this psychologist now looks 50 years back on her students and sees the horrific damage that divorce has done, and the horrific damage that divorce does to children, no matter when the divorce takes place or why. So we're reaping the consequences of a total collapse of our culture. If you think about cultures made out of families, it could not possibly get very much worse. And once again, this comes back to the Christian community must not live that way. Now, let's finish this chapter. Do not defile yourselves with any of these things, for by all these the nations were defiled, which I'm casting out before you. I'm going to send you into the land of Israel, and I'm going to throw out the Canaanites before you. That wasn't done completely like it was supposed to, and the Canaanite influences actually came in later on in history and dragged the Jews back down to their very low levels of behavior. Now, this is interesting. The land is defiled. Sexual immorality defiles the land. In some mysterious way, affects our relationship with nature and with the environment. I don't pretend to have a clue about this. And, as Steve mentioned a little bit, sexual immorality also involves unclean spirits and demonic possession. I don't know if you've ever been around, none of you have here, but if you've ever been around sexually promiscuous people or people that have very loose lifestyles, there's an uncleanness and there's a demonic influence. And very often drugs go hand in hand with all of these really destructive lifestyles. So our moral behavior as Christians is linked to the environment. Should we be surprised at environmental catastrophes? Should we be alarmed that the land wants to vomit out its inhabitants? That's the language that's here. The land is defiled. I will visit punishment on its iniquity upon it, and the land will vomit out its inhabitants. You shall therefore keep my statutes and my judgments and not commit any of these abominations, either any of your own nation or any stranger who sojourns among you. For all these abominations the men of the land have done who were before you, and thus the land is defiled. Lest the land vomit you out also when you defile it, as it vomited out the nations that were before you. It's just this is nature. Nature itself is personified here, and nature has an abhorrence to human misbehavior, and man is the steward over nature, and nature sort of knows that, and nature is designed to respond to godly stewardship. And when the human beings louse up big time, the land sort of knows that. Whoever commits any of these abominations, the persons who commit them shall be cut off from among the people. Therefore you shall keep my ordinance, so that you do not commit any of these abominable customs which were committed before you, and that you do not defile yourselves by them. I am the Lord. Most of you have grown up. If you're young, I think that young people in college today, faced with secular humanism, that have grown up in the secular schools where sexual activity is encouraged from a very early age, and where the gay liberation people come in and talk to you about alternate lifestyles, and you've been brainwashed with all that stuff. It's a knockout, drag-out battle to grow up in today's world and to be morally pure and to walk with God. And this comes in where television and radio and our non-Christian friends are living totally broken down lifestyles, and we have to fight a hard battle.
There's this one family at my daughter's school that is openly promoting masturbation. Now,
sure.
Is that specifically called out in Leviticus at any time?
No, it's not called out. Well, I have a lot of articles about the biggest, best accessed article on my website is my long discussion on masturbation. Masturbation it violates the Levitical law because it's not the purpose for which sex was designed. If you think about it for a minute, sex was designed again within that context of marriage, and any other expression of sex will have the incompleteness and the lack of God's endorsement on it. So lots of pastors and churches take this as a harmless, ordinary practice, and I disagree with that.
Isn't that covered in the section that we went over about bodily emissions?
Any emission of semen makes a person unclean until sunset, and that even includes emission of semen in normal intercourse. But it's just a reminder of the fall. That's all that's there for. So it isn't. That's in no way means that there's anything wrong with sexual intercourse in marriage, and sex is not for just for having children, it's for enjoyment and pleasure, and it's a uniting part of a marriage relationship, and we don't believe that the way the Catholic Church believes that this is tainted part of marriage life. We don't hold that, but okay, we ran out of time. Pretty heavy duty stuff here in the Leviticus, isn't it? And relevant. Father, thank you for speaking so plainly and clearly in Leviticus to us about our lifestyles, the importance of our walking closely with you, the importance of our severing our connections with the values, with the lifestyles of the world around about us, whether it's ambition or career goals or money or all of the worldly goals, or whether it's in the area of sexuality. We're brainwashed with Canaanite sexuality today. The 50 years has seen our nation fall apart. Sexually and morally. And Father, that needs to turn around. We have a nation in moral collapse. And the foundation blocks of the sound society are in marriages and families. And we need those restored. Protect, Lord, and restore the families of America. Not only the Christian families, but the families of the non-Christians as well, that our nation could be preserved, and the land would not vomit us out of this land, which you gave to our forefathers. Anyway, thanks for the plainness and the harshness of these words that are designed for our healing. And forgive us, Father, for tolerating and believing the lies of the world, and cleanse our thoughts and our minds and our lives so that our behavior could be acceptable to you. In the name of Jesus.
Just let me mention there's a newcomer's brunch immediately following the next service. And newcomer is broadly defined. You're all welcome. I don't know what to do if we all showed up, but you're all welcome. Thanks, Lambert.